I'm Marty Moscoe-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Back in December 2014, President Obama announced that the U.S. was thawing its relationship with Cuba, and later he lifted a number of travel and commercial restrictions as the two countries restored diplomatic relations after half a century of hostility. He visited Cuba last spring.
I have come here to bury the last remnant of the Cold War in the Americas. I have come here to extend the hand of friendship to the Cuban people.
Last Friday, President Trump reversed several of those policies while speaking in Little Havana in Miami, Florida, making good on a campaign promise. Here is a slightly edited clip.
Effective immediately, I am canceling the last administration's completely one-sided deal with Cuba. Our new policy begins with strictly enforcing U.S. law. We will not lift sanctions on the Cuban regime until all political prisoners are freed. Freedoms of assembly and expression are respected. All political parties are legalized. And free and internationally supervised elections are scheduled. Elections.
The Cuban Foreign Minister Bruno Rodriguez called Trump's speech a grotesque spectacle straight from the Cold War. The more normalized relations between the two countries has resulted in a travel boom for Cuba and greater cooperation on trafficking and security. But has it led to greater freedoms and human rights for the Cuban people? We have two guests who have joined us. Christopher Sabatini is a lecturer in international relations and policy at the School of International and Public Affairs at Columbia University. He's the founder and executive director of Global Americans and the editor of Latin America Goes Global. Christopher Sabatini, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning, Marty. Thank you.
You're welcome. Roger Noriega is with us as well, former Assistant Secretary of State for Western Hemisphere Affairs, also a former U.S. Ambassador to the Organization of American States, and he coordinates the American Enterprise Institute's program on Latin America. Roger Noriega, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
It's a great pleasure. Thanks for the opportunity.
You're welcome. Roger, let me begin with you. Who is the biggest beneficiary of this new policy under President Trump?
Well, I think that the Cuban people are really the biggest beneficiaries because the previous form of economic engagement under the Obama opening was the regime. And quite consciously, the Trump administration has decided to clamp down on that sort of engagement, the windfall of tourism dollars that go directly into a hotel industry that's dominated by the Cuban military. So I think to the extent that the Cuban people are oppressed by the security apparatus maintained by the Cuban state, paid for by tourism dollars more than anything at this point, I think that they're the beneficiaries of this change, and hopefully we'll find creative new ways to engage them and not play the regime's game of the only way we can engage Cuba is through the regime, and you can't engage the Cuban people except by investing and channeling money into the Cuban state that oppresses them.
I will pick up on several things, but let me get you in on the conversation. Chris, who do you see as the biggest beneficiary of this new policy?
Well, what Roger said is true, is that basically the military is runs about two-thirds of the economy of Cuba. So if you're investing in Cuba, the chances are, especially in the tourism industry, you're investing with the military. That's true. But the way in which travel has been structured, in particular in the last year and a half under President Obama, allowed for more flexibility for citizens to be able to travel and go to what are called casas particulares, or these individual-owned restaurants, the new and private sector entrepreneurs, and they will be hurt by this. The 600,000 U.S. citizens that traveled to Cuba last year, yeah, it's true, many stayed in military-run hotels, but also many, many stay in these casas particulares. You go to Airbnb, you can go and book yourself a room in one of these bed and breakfasts you can go stay in. And this is, you know, according to Airbnb, since it's opened operations in Cuba, which was in 2015, it estimates $40 million in the pockets of Cubans. Now, did some of that find its way into the military? Yes, their income taxes, that's certainly true. But this is Airbnb. A lot of that went to individual Cubans who have these. And this gives them economic and even political space under a regime that is smothering in its economic control and repressive in its economic control. And let's be honest, the military always would find money to repress. It's not like by denying them dollars, they're going to suddenly decide, well, we don't have enough money this year to repress our people. They'll always, it's a repressive regime. They'll repress as they can. And according to surveys, 96% of Cubans on the island supported Obama's changes.
Well, let me pick up on several things, and I'll go back to you, Roger Noriega, thinking, you know, if I had an Airbnb in Havana, or I opened up part of a room in my apartment so that a tourist from America could come to my country and explore Havana, would I be helped by this particular policy?
Well, I think that certainly the people that operate small restaurants and let out rooms in their homes, who are, by the way, grossly overtaxed by the regime, would like to see people visiting the island, and people can still visit Cuba in certain structured ways.
Right.
The question is, you know, is this really the best way that we can help engage people? Is by making it easier for people to sunbathe on apartheid beaches and stay in hotels that the average Cuban can't even enter? Is that really a clever, creative way of engaging the Cuban people when the perverse result of that is a windfall, a shot of adrenaline, really, into the security apparatus in Cuba? We're not just talking about any other kind of Caribbean country. We're talking about an island nation where you have Stalinist control over the economy, with absolutely no political freedom. We have to be more creative than just say, you know, we're gonna join Italians and Canadian tourists on the beaches of Cuba. It just doesn't make any sense. You haven't seen an iota of additional political freedom, or frankly, much economic freedom, in this period of the last decade, where Europe and Canada and Latin America have been flooding the island. It just hasn't produced any change.
Well, let me pick up on that. I'll go back to you, Christopher Sabatini. Does, though, more economic development, even more person-to-person travel and experiences, does that lead to greater reforms? And looking over the last, let's say, year or so under the Obama administration, do we see more or less crackdown on dissidents, political prisoners, critics of the government?
Well, you know, first, let's put this in historical context. There's never been a democratic transition in a country as tight an embargo as on Cuba. Not the Eastern Bloc countries, not the Soviet Union. U.S. citizens could travel to the Soviet Union they could travel to Eastern Europe. If you speak to Eastern European dissidents, in fact, that those cultural and even tourist connections were very, very important in keeping lines of communication open. And indeed, I was just in Cuba in November, and the differences between the Cuba of November, several years after the Obama changes, and what was before was remarkable. First of all, there are over 50 public Wi-Fi hotspots that Google has helped open up, and they are packed. They're public plazas, they're hotel lobbies. It's funny, Cubans, you know as soon as you walk into one, because it's just a clutch of Cubans in a plaza, all looking at their smartphones or their devices, tapping into the internet. Cubans now have access to a whole, what they call a paquete, which is this USB drive that has all the US. Many more Cubans are actually more up to date on Netflix series and documentaries than I am.
Netflix.
Netflix. Yeah, you know, they're downloading all this stuff and they're passing it around. This is coming through the steady flow of people back and forth. you know, it was remarkable. I mean, I would encourage Roger to go to Cuba and compare it from the last time he was there when Pope John Paul was there, because it is a remarkably different place. Again, is the government still repressive? Yes. And it uses now, its tactics are more subtle and more temporary, but it still represses. The, you know, the only media that's allowed are official state media, although there is a growing world of internet investigative reporting and blogs. The government now, actually what it does is tends to temporarily detain and harass dissidents and threaten them rather than jailing them for long sentences. But, you know, the truth is one of the worst crackdowns in the history of modern history of Cuba was in 2003 when Cuban government rounded up 75 dissidents and put them for jail terms of up to 20, and on average 20 years. So there's no correlation between this, the tightness of the embargo, and the government's repression. It's going to repress. And this is really, question is, what is a long-term strategy that opens up people's ability to communicate and have contact with the outside world and be able to gain some measure of economic and political space from the regime?
Well, let me pick up on that and go back to you, Roger Noriega. Then how does this new Trump policy, basically focusing on more sort of person-to-person travel, you can't do that independently as an American, and also saying that you can't deal, if you're a business person, you can't deal with the government, which includes the military and its security and its kind of sprawling network there. How would that bring about greater freedoms for the Cuban people? Because I'm assuming that's what everybody wants.
Right. And I would note that the one thing that the Trump changes did not do was impact in any way on the access to telecommunications, to internet access, all of this, which, by the way, is doled out by the regime at its own discretion. So the 300% increase, I think, I've seen of Cubans participating in social media, I mean, that's from a very low base, but it is sure. Important. It is significant. And I certainly don't think that we should disrupt that in any way. As a matter of fact, we ought to find more creative ways to actually engage the Cuban people, and you know, until the regime decides that it wants to cut those things off. I think we need to have our diplomats being more active and more creative in engaging Cubans. One of the perverse results of the Obama opening was we were so determined to engage the regime that human rights activists, dissidents, independent journalists told me that they were virtually abandoned by the U.S. embassy. They were and by the Europeans and by the Latin Americans. So I think that, you know, we certainly need to think in a more creative way. You know, the engagement in Eastern Europe is one model, but now we have the internet and social media sure. And all these things. And I think that
Roger,
these individual tools. Yeah, yes, I'm sorry. Go ahead,
that's
please.
Okay. Hold on to that thought, only because mm-hmm. We have to take a very short break and we'll get back to our conversation. That's Roger Noriega joining us along with Christopher Sabatini. We are talking about Cuba, U.S.-Cuba relations. We want to hear from you. You can call or text our comment line 267-405-2006. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. If you have been to Cuba, born in Cuba, planning on going to Cuba, part of a Cuban-American family, we want your response to President Trump's new Cuba policy. What do you think the relationship between the U.S. and Cuba should be? And again, you can call or text our comment line 267-405-2006. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Roger, I had to interrupt you only because we were coming up on a break, but you have said several times that we need to come up with a more creative way to engage Cuba. What would that be? And does this new policy, which I must say leaves intact, the embassies are still open, Cuban Americans can travel and send money to Cuba, there's still direct flights and cruises to Cuba from the United States. What is a more creative way to deal with the problems that you see?
Well, I think that's really the most important question, because, you know, people here in the United States who make policy on Cuba used to spend their time thinking of ways of engaging people, giving them access to information, the ability of Cubans, for that matter, to be able to travel here to the United States, to interact with Americans here, to find ways to crack down on resources going to the regime that oppresses these people. I think that in the last really decade, we found some ways of opening up in terms of internet access and things of that, some of which is done at the forbearance of the Cuban regime.
Right.
And we have to find ways to work around that. But I have to just say that we used to use that creativity to engage the people. Now we have people who used to prioritize that, looking at finding ways to justify that the only way to engage the Cuban people is doing precisely what their government says we need to do,
but in terms of
allowing trade and travel and all these things.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying, and I do want to get back to you, Christopher Sabatini, but Roger, I'm thinking again about that person that has an Airbnb or has turned part of their apartment into a place where Americans can come. They're going to have meals together. They're going to talk together. They're going to tell them, where you can get a really good dinner or breakfast or lunch or what sites to see in Cuba. Is that not a good thing to have that kind of person-to-person contact?
That's a very positive thing, and no doubt some of these people who visit Cuba are going to leave the island with a guilty conscience because they participated in supporting this oppressive apparatus.
But I think many of them, and this is based on people that I know have been there, saying they didn't leave with a guilty conscience. They left feeling they had some really good conversations with Cuban people.
And I agree with that, and it's a great exercise for people here in the States to get to know the reality of the island. But the main voice being heard from on these Obama openings and the Trump reaction are people who are motivated by profit. The cruise industry, so other folks that are looking to invest on the island and are afraid that they're going to miss out on opportunities to exploit the Cuban people and cheap wages and all of that. And that's really perverse. I mean, these people that have made the case for the last decade that we have to engage Cuba, that we're losing out, have become lobbyists for the status quo. Not voices of change, not people who have come back and talked about their conversations with around the dinner table with average Cubans, but people that are interested in doing business with the regime and consolidating their sweetheart deals with the current regime. And so I think that's been one of the most damaging things. When you had the quote that President Obama said that he was burying the last remnant of the Cold War in the Americas,
right.
Well, that wasn't the U.S. embargo. That's the last remnant of the Cold War in the Americas is the Castro regime, which still has Stalinist control, which still has absolute control over the economy, which is planning now a dynastic transition in 2018 to a hand-picked successor to Raul. That hasn't changed. That's what we need to focus on and put our energies behind considering ways to empower people, to communicate with people, to have purposeful travel. Yes, double, triple the amount of people that go there on religious and cultural scientific exchanges. But the people that are going there because it's a cheap place to get a tan, I think is real. I mean, Americans
belittling people that want to go to Cuba because they not just to lie on the beaches, but because they want to understand that country that has really been cut off for so many Americans. Let me get Christopher Sabatini back in on the conversation. I want to quote something from a Jose Daniel Ferrer Garcia, head of the Cuban Patriotic Union. He apparently welcomed and backed President Obama's thaw in the relationship with Cuba, but he said recently, and he apparently wrote to President Trump, he said, "We believe that this is the moment for a maximum reversal of some policies that only benefit the Castro regime, does very little or nothing for the oppressed people. It's time to impose strong sanctions on the regime of Raul Castro." If you can respond to both what Roger Noriega said, but also what Garcia said about this thaw and whether it's just benefiting, Starwood hotels and things like that, or whether it's really benefiting the Cuban people.
Sure. First, just a few things and comments on Roger's comments. I agree that more can be done to support human rights at times even President Obama's statement over Fidel Castro's death was more than unfortunate. I think you can support human rights and support a loosening of the embargo that tries to further people's freedoms. Not everyone who was in favor of Obama's changes are greedy, rapacious capitalists simply looking for a cheap profit. That's for that reason that the major human rights groups, Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International, groups that have consistently called out human rights abuses in Cuba, they are in favor of Obama's changes. And as last I checked, Human Rights Watch didn't operate a cruise line that went to Cuba, but they issued a very strong statement urging President Trump not to roll back the changes. So there are other reasons to support this that have to do with human rights, that don't have to do with profit. Trying to pretend that everyone who goes or everyone who advocates for change is somehow greedy is a gross disservice. The second, though, is the issue about the quote you mentioned. And look, it is true. I think, there is always a risk in dealing. The Castro government plays victim very, very well. And they always have had for a long time a sort of trigger finger when it comes to not accepting any criticism and threatening to upset, the card table and go home. That has led people, whether it's scholars or whether it's businesses, to not sort of raise the tough questions when they're trying to sort of cut a deal with or even engage in diplomatic negotiations with the Castro government. And indeed, I think the U.S. government and under Obama at times trimmed its sails. It could have raised human rights issues more. It should have done more to welcome dissidents even in the White House. Mm-hmm. And it just didn't do that. And so I share some of the frustration with the human rights activists that went there. And indeed, I'll also say that, the last round of Obama-era changes did flirt with the law or outright violated. The Starwood deal that you referenced, Marty, which is there are two of them, actually, that are co-ventures with Gaviota, the military hotel company, is, it is problematic. Now, the problem, though, actually, it's more than problematic. It could very well be immoral. But the problem, though, is that the Trump changes now have removed what was the previous policy under Obama in which people could go under people-to-people contact simply by self-declaring at the airport they were going there for cultural travel. And that right. opened it up and opened up the opportunities for the bed and breakfast that you mentioned, Marty. The problem now is it's scaled back up, or will be probably within 90 days, to require individuals to go under a prepackaged Treasury Department approved travel provider. And the problem is those types of travel providers don't put people up in the casas particulares, in the bed and breakfast. They put them up in the big hotels, and the big hotels are the ones that are owned by the military. So you have this real contradiction, almost immoral contradiction. The policy that's supposed to help the independent entrepreneur is actually likely to create incentives for a more military hotel-oriented stays, where the Smithsonian or the National Geographic, if it takes down 20, 30, 40 people, is going to need to put people up in these military-controlled hotels. It simply isn't logistically possible to get them into the individual small-scale entrepreneurial hospitality service industry. So there's a real contradiction there that no one has explained to me.
Well, let me jump in and let me just put something else on the table here. And I'm not sure either of you can answer for President Trump, but it is interesting to compare his criticism of the Castro regime and his praising of Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte, who has executed criminals, who has called the Pope a son of a whore. He's compared himself to Hitler. I'm looking at Vox here. President Trump praised him for fighting very hard to get rid of his country of drugs. President Trump invited Sisi of Egypt to the White House, and we know that he took power in a coup. He has praised the president of Turkey, who was able to consolidate power after a referendum. How should we, Roger Noriega, how should we understand or even reconcile this criticism for the Castro regime coming from the president and his, and I should add Putin to the mix, and his giving so many other dictators a pass?
I don't think it's possible to do that. And, I certainly wouldn't be the person he'd call as a character witness either.
I hear you.
Let me just make a comment on the Human Rights Watch. I note that, and this is important because the statement that the Human Rights Watch put out before was before Trump made his announcement. And it'd be interesting to go back to these folks, who some of whom were, one of them was a very good friend, and ask them what they think about the narrow measures that was taken with respect to the kinds of hotels, which, I mean, Chris used the word immoral, mm-hmm. Run by Gaviota, the military hotel or a military company that channels money right into the security apparatus. I wonder what they would think about that. The other thing is the something that was untouched, and I think something we should emphasize is the role of Cuban exiles. The ability of them to travel, I don't think, was disrupted or touched at all.
Nope.
To send money to their families.
Right.
And I think that is really the secret weapon here. More contact, because you're going to need that sort of family-loving kind of relationship, trust relationships, to leach the toxins out of society in Cuba today, that the regime has used as an instrument of control. And so I think that they have to play an important role.
Just a quick follow-up to that. I mean, it seems like what President Trump did was to leave intact what had come under President Obama before, which was that Cuban Americans can travel more freely and they can also send money. Is that any different under Trump?
No, I don't believe it was impacted at all.
But you're saying that's a good thing.
I think it's a positive thing because those people are not – they have a broader, a more redeeming reason for their travel. And I certainly don't want to impugn – I have good friends that have traveled to Cuba with the sense of wanting to understand what the reality is there. And those are the kinds of people you want to have go. Mm. But if we can find a way as they draft these regs to maybe push things in the direction, push travel in the direction of people staying in private homes and out of the big hotels. I think that that's one of the things you essentially do by saying we're going to crack down on investment in that sector is try to favor the private homes, the paladares.
Let me play a caller that speaks to just what you just said there, Roger. And Chris, I'll have give you a chance to respond. This is a caller to our comment line.
My name is Francis. I live in Newtown, Pennsylvania, and I've been traveling to Cuba for the last 35 years. I have a number of friends there, but now under the new regulations, I won't be able to visit them for their 25th wedding anniversary, which comes up. It appears to me that Cubans are more free to travel than I am. I've just had Cubans in my home who have been here before, and now they don't need any government permission, but I can't even go and visit them in Cuba. I'm also concerned about how isolated the United States is in the world when the UN votes 191-0 against our embargo. It seems to me it's important for us to be in tune with the world and also allow freedom of travel.
Chris, you want to respond to that?
Yeah, a few points. One he's raised some very good points about the risk of U.S. isolation and the embargo. We're certainly out of step. We hand the Cubans, unfortunately, a public relations victory every year, which they love to remind us of. I'm unfortunately in Cuba one time right after during the vote, and every meeting opened that way. There is a risk of isolation, especially in light of our inconsistent policies when it comes to the Philippines and Turkey and Egypt. So that really does, I think, create somewhat of a dent on our moral authority globally. I would say this, though. He says the Cubans are free to travel, and that's partially true, but, there are a few Cuban dissidents who couldn't attend the Trump rally last week. Beto Soler was prohibited from traveling. So, yeah, if you're a citizen who isn't going to be speaking out against the government, you're free to travel. That does not apply equally. We need to remember this is a government that does not brook any sort of opposition and is happy to curtail people's freedoms based on their political orientation. That doesn't justify any sort of restrictions on U.S. travel, but let's try to remember this is a government that does use those tools. I'll just actually add one thing. I agree with with Roger about the need to sort of try to figure out how the regulations will not benefit the large hotels and benefit the cuenta propistas, so the entrepreneurs and the bed and breakfast. I think that's going to be the key. I hope there. And it's a good point too. It's what do the human rights groups, what will they say? Because I think many people were bracing for a fuller rollback of the Obama era policies, and that's certainly the impression that President Trump gave in that clip that you said. But in fact, when you look to the details, it was actually far, far less. It was not a complete rejection of the Obama era rules. We still have normalized diplomatic relations. We're still collaborating on issues of human trafficking and the environment. We still will allow for some forms of travel, people to people. And of course, Cuban American, the previous restrictions on Cuban American travel and Cuban American remittances to the island that existed under George W. Bush have been lifted and will remain so. So it's not as dramatic as many thought, and I would be interested in hearing what people think.
Absolutely. In fact, let me read a bunch of email comments that we have here. One from Stu, let's be clear, Trump's action is only for GOP political advantage. Carolyn says, my husband and I have cruise reservations for a November trip to Cuba to celebrate our 35th anniversary. What do these changes mean to us? I would say call your travel agent to find out. Apparently, this is going to take 90 days before some kind of implementation. An email from Andrew. Didn't we try maximum sanctions over the last 50 years on Cuba with little effect on the regime? The Trump administration seems bent on scoring political points by bashing good Obama policies and cynically wants to claim they support human rights when they show little interest in them elsewhere. I will read one more comment from Lourdes. I'm a Cuban American who came to the U.S. in 61 as a Pedro Pan kid. Speaking of economic rationale, could this backsliding be due to the fact that South Florida will suffer severely in tourism if Cuba opens up even more? Let's take a very short break and we'll get back to our conversation talking about U.S.-Cuba relations under the Trump administration. And again, if you've been to Cuba, if you are Cuban American, if your family came here from Cuba, we want to hear from you. You can text or call our comment line 267-405-2006. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. What should the relationship between the U.S. and Cuba be? We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking about Cuba-U.S. relations in the Trump era. Our guests are Christopher Sabatini. He's a lecturer at the at Columbia University, founder and executive director of Global Americans, also editor of Latin America Goes Global. Roger Noriega with us as well, former Assistant Secretary of State for Western Hemisphere Affairs and a former U.S. ambassador to the Organization of American States, and he coordinates the American Enterprise Institute's program on Latin America. Roger, let me go back to you. Something I think that Chris referenced, that for Cuba, with 50 years of the embargo in place, that was often used by the Cuban government to, in a sense, sort of explain away some of the hardships that the Cuban people had to endure, a kind of a convenient punching bag, if you will. Does that make sense to you?
Well, it's certainly something I've heard for a good long while from people mostly outside of Cuba, because the regime there doesn't exist by billboards and speeches, at least anymore. It exists by a police being a police state and imposing totalitarian restrictions on any kind of talk or association of one Cuban with another. So, I think that's an excuse that certainly has worked outside of Cuba, and to say that Cuba is a victim, and it's worked magnificently. And now the United States is in step with the rest of Latin America in not giving a damn about the way the Cuban people live in terms of oppression. At least under the Obama policy, we sort of abandoned these human rights activists and dissidents, and now we're sort of in step with Latin America and ignoring them. And one of the results of this Obama opening was supposed to be to bridge that gap to our Latin American friends and get them to be more vocal. None of that has happened. As a matter of fact, in the last few weeks, the Colombian government actually threatened to boycott a meeting on Central America with here in Miami because the Cuban government was saying that, they're going to impose new measures on us. And they leverage their relationships with these Latin governments vis-a-vis the United States rather than have these Latin American governments turn their attention at the way that regime oppresses its own people, and for that matter, the way that regime is participating directly in the destruction of Venezuela in South America, and all of that has been ignored.
Yeah, and we've done shows on Venezuela, which is an issue in and unto itself, but not disconnected from Cuba. Let me though turn to you, Chris. Which Raul Castro announced last week that he was going to step down next year. Interesting. What opportunities does that create for the Cuban people?
Well, if the Cuban government were to have its way, none. They've already handpicked the successor. It's this man by the name of Díaz-Canel. He's in the Cuban system, he's a spry mid-50s relative to the 80-something Raul Castro and the sort of average age of the Politburo, which is about 70. This is clearly a sort of cultivated Kremlin-style succession. No one really knows much about Díaz-Canel. There are rumors that he may be a little bit more progressive, a little more forward-leaning, but he's been really very much a party apparatchik. So it's unclear what change there will be. But I think it is a moment of change. I mean, soon there will not be a Castro in power, although right. It does look like Raul Castro's son, Alejandro Castro, seems to be somewhat of a power behind the throne. So we'll see how much he retains in there. But, this is a process of change. And, this is a regime that has been, hasn't really renovated leadership since the revolution in 1959. So they are entering newfound territory. So while I don't expect any rapid opening, there's too much at risk for a number of people. There do have to be changes. And economically, with or without the U.S. Changes, the Cuban economy is in dire straits. It has not generated the types of foreign direct investment that it needs. It needs to correct its bizarre two-currency policy, and unifying its currency would probably bring inflation and higher consumer prices for consumer goods. This is a regime that's sitting on top of a whole series of difficult economic decisions and a stalling economy that it will have to address. And we'll see if the next government or the next leadership group has the credibility and the power to be able to do it.
But what if they don't? I mean, what if it continues what has been in place for the last 50 years? And, I mean, whether this generation that took over, as you say, in their 70s, Fidel Castro dying, Raul Castro is quite elderly himself. Are we going to see the dying off of this regime with the opening up for new sort of more moderate leaders? Or do you see, Chris, and to you, Roger, as well, the kind of continuation, into the 21st century?
Well, Marty, you're asking me to make predictions.
I am.
But I'll try.
But
just don't hold me to them, okay?
I will.
I think there is a group of younger leaders that realize that change is due. There are groups of economists who have been advising the government, who are quite open about the unsustainability of this current economic model, especially given all the different bottlenecks in the market. I think what you'll start to see is a very tentative opening up in some areas that may require the new leadership to begin to reach out to incorporate some elements of glasnost-like opening, political opening that sort of takes some pressure off the regime. And then I think that's when things start to happen. And, will Díaz-Canel be Cuba's Gorbachev? I'm not so sure that will be the case, but I think there's a good chance that if not him, then someone else will be, because there definitely is a need for an economic opening. And with that will come the need for some form of political co-optation, almost, if you will.
Roger, please do, and then I'll read
Sorry
of comments. No, that's okay.
Look, this is precisely the point. I mean, I'm now in my second or third generation of moderate, youthful, creative, open leaders in the Cuban regime. Remember, Raul Castro is the latest reformer. Right. And he, if anything, he's cracked down even more. And here's a crazy thought in terms of the transition. How about an election? Why don't we get Latin America, the Caribbean, European countries to talk about the self-determination of the Cuban people through an election? And and also the point that Chris was making, it's a very valid point, that the Cuban regime, the Cuban economy is in very dire straits. And we're coming in now with this Obama relaxation and giving a shot of adrenaline to that very regime, instead of looking for a day and working for a day where the Cuban people, incredibly creative, productive people, in the pre-Castro times, they were at European levels in socioeconomic indicators, and now they're down with Bolivia and Haiti and Honduras. We need to think of ways of challenging the regime to open up through elections. And maybe it's not President Trump who can do that. Maybe it'll be President Sass or President whomever.
Scanning the horizon for some names for you.
That might be, thank you very much. Cuomo, okay, let's say Cuomo, would be in a position to make that sort of appeal. But I think it's important for us to keep our eye on the ball that when we're talking about what should the relationship between the United States and Cuba be, that Cuba is not the regime. It's 11 million Cubans we need to emphasize our relationship with them, and how do we improve that relationship, reach out to them, communicate with them, and do what all we can in the world, really, so that they can communicate with one another and plan for their own future.
But, and we've done whole hours on this, Roger, just quickly, if you
no
don't
doubt.
Mind, but the embargo, which was in place for, as we all know, 50-some years, did not get rid of the Castro regime, bring about, there are parts of Cuba, they have a good health system and education system and things like that, but nonetheless, that regime has still maintained control. Sometimes the definition of craziness is, doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results.
Right. And I will say this, that every president since Johnson tinkered with the embargo or made significant changes. Some considered outright lifting it. But only until President Obama came along did he just give the regime everything it wanted and promised to give more. And so we have to be more creative than that, I would say, at the very least. I would trust a guy like Chris Sabatini as Assistant Secretary of State for Western Hemisphere or Director of or Special Envoy for Cuba to think of creative ways to empower the people. Mm. I would do that in a heartbeat, because this is what he used to do as a professional and to a certain extent still does. But, managing programs to help people on the island. I would trust him to do that. I don't necessarily trust, CEOs of cruise lines to say that, the kind of people who look at Cuba and say the only thing wrong with Cuba today is that we can't get in on the exploitation. Mm. We need to have people with the right orientation, energy, empowerment to work with our neighbors to help Cuba. Once and for all.
Let me read a couple of comments. A tweet from Connie. I can't wait to return. She was in Cuba recently, and she said, I can't wait to return. An email from Bob. I went to Cuba 10 years ago. It was one of the most impactful trips of my life. Celeste had a question about human rights in Cuba. It was something that we had mentioned, comparing the human rights in Saudi Arabia, the Philippines, and other countries that the Trump administration praises. We actually addressed that a little bit earlier in the hour. An email from Meredith. Had a great honor of participating in a legally sanctioned agricultural exchange to Cuba in 2003. A beautiful country, incredibly engaging people, very mixed group with North, Central, and South American academics. Cuba is the only country that we maintain these ridiculous barriers from within. Let me play a call from someone who called our comment line.
My name is Andy. I'm from Philadelphia. I'm a veteran who served in our armed forces. I take offense to the fact that I have a president that tells me where I can and cannot go. I don't have the money to go on these big tours. I've been to Cuba before. It's a great place to travel. I stayed with a family down there. I want to go back and see them. I'm not allowed to go. Is this freedom?
You want to respond to that, Chris? He's saying, I resent being told by my president, although we should say that Congress has a role to play in this, having, you know, basically in control of the embargo itself. But can you respond to our caller, Andy?
Yeah, I would say I certainly sympathize. I have actually friends whose daughter is supposed to have an art exhibition in Cuba. They don't know whether they'll be able to go down and attend the opening. And it's a problem. I mean, we'll have to see how the regulations come out. And I sincerely hope for people like your listener and people like my friend's daughter and my friends that the regulations do not close off those opportunities for travel, because that's the sort of meaningful travel we really need. But let me also say, your caller is absolutely right. This is a restriction on freedom. But it would also be good if people also started to speak out about the restrictions of freedom in Cuba as well, and not just restrictions. And I agree with Roger, and I'm just saying this because he just complimented me, but I agree with him that the Obama administration did not use the political capital regionally that it had, or that it was supposedly going to get by these changes towards Cuba, for any policy towards Venezuela or even towards Cuba. And I think that was a shame. We were sort of told that we were going to improve our relations and alliances and trust in the region, and I just didn't see, to quote George W. Bush, us spending that political capital in the way that would have been useful. So, yes, I hope the travel regulations allow for individuals to be able to travel freely and meet with friends and family and create new friends. That's what this should all be about. It shouldn't really be about, and this I also agree with Roger, it shouldn't be about Starwood Hotels. It shouldn't be about the cruise lines. Cruise lines are, whether it's Cuba or Jamaica, are one of the worst forms of tourism in terms of people-to-people contacts. So let's wait and see how the regulations come out. But let's hope, you know, citizens also, as your caller did, raise their voices and explain why it's important to them that they be able to travel.
Roger, I hate to raise this because we're almost out of time here, but a woman named Joanne Chesimard is basically escaped to Cuba after she killed a trooper in New Jersey. She was given asylum in Cuba. President Trump wants her return. So does Governor Chris Christie. How important do you think this case is?
Well, I think it's extraordinarily important when we are talking about wanting our neighbors to respect the rule of law. And it's certainly important to this family, but it also is important to our country in terms of particularly murder of a law enforcement officer, people who have committed acts of terrorism who find a safe haven there. And let me just make one closing comment very quickly. And the many messages you read, maybe 8 or 10 of them, people have traveled to Cuba.
Yes.
It's hard for me to think that they've just traveled within the last 6 or 8 months under the Obama regulations. So people have traveled to Cuba for a good long while. One of the ladies said she went there in 2003. Another guy's been going for 35 years. So people are finding their ways to travel legally and probably otherwise. But there are a lot of forms of lawful travel. And, you know, we'll see how the regulations are written to be able to accommodate individuals that are going there for particular purposes.
Well, on that note,
they need to be creative about that, too.
Roger Noriega, thank you for joining us today in Radio Times.
My pleasure.
Thank you. You're welcome. He's the coordinator of the American Enterprise Institute's program on Latin America. Christopher Sabatini, thank you for joining us as well.
Thanks, Marty. It was great.
Great for us as well. He's a lecturer at Columbia University, founder and executive director of Global Americans, and the editor of Latin America Goes Global. We appreciate all those comments and calls to Radio Times. Obviously, a lot of interest in this topic, which interested us as well. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about the program, downloading a podcast of the show, and checking us out on Facebook and Twitter. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thanks for joining us.